Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And today on the program, we're talking insects, we're talking seeds, and we're talking the thin leaf alder. So we're going to start out talking about insects with Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we'd love to have you join our conversation at 1-800-826-1495 or go online and send us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Welcome again.
Oh, thanks, Brian. It's great to be here.
I love this time of year because not only do I know that you're coming in once a month, but there's always so much to talk about.
So much to talk about. No shortage.
Exactly. Okay, so let's start off with coddling moth.
Yeah.
Right off the bat. I haven't sprayed yet. Now, I haven't seen any damage yet either, but I also know
you're playing
from the publication
risky.
That you send out that this is a really high egg hatch time period for at least my garden in Hyde Park.
Right. So that's a good topic to bring up because right now we're either in the heat of coddling moth first generation for those in the more cooler, more northern regions or high elevation regions, or you're winding down first generation if you're more along the Wasatch Front, some of the little warmer spots in northern Utah. And so right now, as you mentioned, for Cache Valley, we're in that period of what we call peak egg hatch, which is when the highest percentage or proportion of the eggs are hatching. And why you care about that is that with coddling moth, it's the little first instar, we call it, so the little tiny little caterpillar that gets into the apple and pear fruits, that's the concern, and they get in very quickly after they hatch, within 24 hours. So once that little worm, little larva, tunnels in, then you've got, you know, the proverbial worm in the fruit.
Apparently they like green apples.
They do. And they like, they'll go in through the calyx end, they'll go through the side. What they really are looking for are the seeds, interesting enough. They're actually a seed feeder, and basically the flesh of the apple and the pear is just something they have to tunnel through to get to their most desired food source.
So it seems like, and I don't know, maybe I'm just not noticing this correctly, but it seems like they'd like to go in through the blossom.
That's the calyx end.
And it makes it a lot harder to find.
It's hard to see it until they're what we call their frass, which is their sawdust-like insect poop, is hanging out the bottom of the apple. When you see that, then you're like, oh, one's in there, and I didn't even realize it.
And we've talked about this before, but I kind of do like to wait until I see a little bit of damage before I spray so I can go as long as possible. Any idea how this year is shaping up to be when it was hot and dry and then rainy and wet?
In general, we're seeing fairly light fruit insect population. So coddling moth, peach twig borer, we've hardly caught any, even in places down in Utah County in the major commercial peach growing areas. The trap catch has been very low.
Did I just see something? Was it yesterday I was reading about the greater peach
tree borer,
which is different, has been found.
Right now it's just starting to emerge. But in general, we're seeing fairly light populations of some of those insects this year. Not all insects, but those kind that are, you know, our fruit attacking moth type pests. And so I think we can attribute it to a number of things. We did have a fairly warm early, late winter, was very warm and hot and dry. And so things were moving along so quickly. So we were kind of slated for a really early emergence. But then we had that cool off in temperatures in April, then lots of rain in May. And so I think that just really put the skids on, so to speak. And it just slowed everything way down. But I think it also probably damaged some of the populations. That is, there weren't, they didn't survive some of those inclement weather conditions.
And
we're okay with that. So we're seeing lighter pressure in general. Doesn't mean everybody will see that, but in general. So check our IPM advisory, the tree fruit IPM advisory that comes out every couple weeks. And that gives you an update on where the timing for these different insects stand. And so if you're along Wasatch Front area, you're winding down with that first generation. There'll be a little gap between first and second. So second generation is predicted to start right around the July 4th kind of time period. So there'll be a little gap between late June and that first week of July when the coddling moth is in between generations.
And if you go to upr.org and on the drop-down tab for programs, go to Zesty Garden, all you've got to do is just scroll down just a tiny bit, and there is a direct link to sign up for the pest advisories. This one in particular, there's landscape, there's one for small fruits, tree fruit IPM advisory, turf IPM advisory, and the Utah Pest News quarterly newsletter. Right. And you can sign up for one or for all of these. Receive it as a PDF attachment. And as we mentioned last time, they don't come every day. In fact, they don't come every week. Usually it's just as needed.
Right. So. And it's about every other week or every 10 days or so. And the nice thing about this is we have about nearly 20 sites, I believe, that we give you weather or timing information for the insects. We have weather stations in those areas that we can then run our insect development models and tell you for about 20 different sites in northern Utah where what the timing will be for your area.
So, for instance, I'm looking at this upside down. Go to Grand County.
Okay.
Grand County's
there for Moab. So we're they ended their first generation of coddling moth just a few days ago, and they're slated to begin their second generation on June 23rd. So
if they haven't seen, if they've already sprayed, mm-hmm. and they haven't had any damage, they don't need to spray again until the 23rd.
Right. Right.
Using this information.
Right.
You know, why spray the tree when it's
You don't need to be spraying now or in between the generations. So it gives you a little break. And this is predicted as of this last advisory. And so do visit, when the new advisory comes out, it's good to get an update and check and see where we are. Because as temperatures warm or cool, it affects how fast this goes.
So that's kind of helpful. So what about Iron County? We're looking around the state.
Yes. So for Cedar City Airport is where our weather station is. So our period of greatest egg hatch ends in just a few days on the 24th of June. And we don't yet have a prediction for beginning of the second because they're a little cooler and a little further out. But we will in our next advisory.
So if you didn't want to have to keep spraying all the time, you would concentrate your spraying during the period of greatest egg hatch?
That's right. That's right. That's when you're most likely to get the most entries, the most caterpillars entering your fruit.
So not only are you saving your fruit, but you're saving money. That's what these advisories are doing.
Right. Saving you money, saving you the number of insecticide applications you have to make. And that's what integrated pest management is all about, trying to be as use information to be as precise and as effective as possible.
And again, just go to upr.org, click on the programs tab and drop down to Zesty Garden, and you'll find a direct link to sign up for these. There's different advisories, but this is the one we're talking about is the plant pest advisory. Mm-hmm. And I would say this is the one that probably comes most often.
It is.
And the other ones, there might only be one, maybe two during the growing season. So
We have a new vegetable IPM assistant named Bonnie Bunn. And so she's going to be helping us get more of the vegetable advisories out. So we hope to have those more frequently too.
And this gives you great color photos so you can look at the various issues and know whether you have that same issue in your garden. So.
Right. If I could, I wanted to mention a couple of issues. They're not actually insects, but that we have had the most calls and inquiries about in the last 2-3 weeks. And these are related, one, to winter kill, which is, we think, happened last December when we had that really quick drop in temperatures, 20-degree drop in temperatures. We're seeing quite a few people, particularly peach trees, but I'm sure I know it's also sweet cherry and any kind of tree that's not as winter hardy. We, even though our temperatures weren't phenomenally low, but we went from quite warm temperatures to cold temperatures very rapidly. And so trees that are not as well adapted to that kind of rapid change had some winter kill. And so what this did is killed some of the conductive tissue in the tree, some of the cambial tissue. And so what we're seeing now is trees starting to collapse, limbs collapsing. Particularly we've seen this in peach varieties that are more bred for California and warmer places, and they're just not holding up very well. I mean, I'm not even talking about that they may have lost their fruit due to the fruit spring freeze. I'm just talking about they're actually losing trees.
I noticed this, and it seems to be becoming more common here where we stay warm, and all of a sudden, poof, we go way cold. Last year, meaning 2014.
Right.
There was another one of these events, and so my peaches, I had to reorder.
Right. So it's really hard when people realize that, I'm losing the whole tree. I'm not just losing this year's crop. And so I encourage people to consider these kinds of more extreme weather conditions we do get when you do select a variety of peach or sweet cherry or even an ornamental tree to order, and don't do something that's a little too risky for this area. The other thing I wanted to bring up was with that very wet May that we had, all up and down northern Utah, we are seeing a lot of a fungal disease called Carinium blight. And this is a disease we commonly see on apricot. It makes little pimples on the fruit. And in the leaves of the tree, you see the shot hole effect where the little fungal lesion was there originally. It was kind of a yellow color, and then it turns brown, and those little round circular areas drop out of the leaf, making it look like someone shot a shotgun through the leaves and left that shot hole effect. But this year, we're seeing it on peach. We're seeing it much more severely than we ever had. I even have seen in tart cherry commercial orchards down in Utah County where a lot of the fruit has been damaged by this particular fungus, and it's all due to the very wet conditions that we had during May. And commercial growers do apply fungicides to protect the fruit, but most homeowners, you know, we don't get these conditions that often, so we're not aware that we even need to do that until then we see the damage later. So if you have little raised pimples on your apricot, peach, even cherry fruits, if you have a lot of the shot hole, these little round holes in your leaves, that is Carinium blight. At this point, it's a little too late to do anything about. This is something that you'd have to take care of back when the fruits were forming, when the leaves were growing, and we had these wet conditions. You would have needed to apply a fungicide probably several applications given the long wetting period we had.
Do you know where the fungus overwinters? Is it in the leaf material?
It's actually on the twigs and in the buds. So in the buds, I think inside the buds on the twigs. And so when those buds start to open in the spring, then the fungus is there, and then it can, with rain and moisture, it can spread then onto the fruit and so forth.
So where it's been so bad this year, probably next year, even if we don't have a lot of rain.
Yep.
It's still going to be there,
right.
and if you've got it in your garden, you would do well to prevent it.
You'll also see dieback in the twigs because it will kill buds as well if it's bad enough. So you may see some just dieback and some of the younger growth that you'll need to be pruning out this winter. Another option that is organic that homeowners and commercial growers use is using a copper material. And the timing for that would be either in the fall, right after when you're starting to get leaf drop, and that kind of it kind of seals off the buds and keeps the fungus from getting in there. Or it's also in the spring. So next year when you'd be doing your delayed dormant spray, when the buds are starting to open, you can also use a copper material, copper fungicide at that time.
I noticed in my iris, because I have a lot of iris, that I have iris leaf spot. And it's in one section there in the back. It gets a little bit more shade.
So let me tell you about that. That also goes to onions.
Ooh, okay. Well, that's not good.
So that's not good. If you've got it that much in your iris and you've got a lot of iris, right, you know, in your yard, near your garden. Yeah, so that's the same virus. It's called iris yellow spot, and it's vectored by thrips, which are omnipresent, onion thrips, western flower thrips. And so that can be a problem in your onions you might see later in the summer.
So is it a bacterium?
No, it's an actual virus.
Oh, it's a virus.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the thrips pick it up, and it's propagative. That means it replicates inside the thrips itself and then comes back out through its salivary glands that it injects when it's feeding on different plants. And so the thrips will go from the virus to the onion or to the leeks or to the garlic. But I think of all those, iris and onion, are the most susceptible. So I hope you don't have a problem with that.
Mm. Well, it seems to, I thought it was related to the high moisture, because I haven't seen it getting any worse. Mm-hmm. And it was in an area that got a little more shade than my other iris, which seem to be just fine. And I know that there is a virus in iris, or not a virus, a fungus, mm-hmm. that you have to clean out the leaf material by the end of the year. And so I'll just spray, when I'm spraying my stone fruits, I'll just spray the iris as well.
So.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm Brian Earle, and in with me is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we'd love to have your questions or comment. You can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can call us. It's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So from our perusal through entomology today, some interesting topics. And the first one I wanted to hit upon was about the varroa mite. And we've talked about this mite before, but this article was just fascinating to me how, and there's a photo that we'll, I'll post to our website, the Zesty Garden website, so you can actually see what the mite looks like. And in comparison to the size of the bee, it's smaller, of course, but still it's pretty good size.
You can see them on there.
And
on
bees
the...
do a lot of grooming, so I've always wondered why do they not groom these things off?
Well, as you notice, when I see pictures of them, I'm not a honeybee keeper, but I imagine if I was and I had seen these in the colony, you would notice they tend to go right up on the kind of the back, kind of like, you know,
they can't reach,
like
too.
How we have a hard time reaching that middle of our back. It's the same thing for the bees. That's where the mites tend to hang out, because the ones that are closer to their legs and are easier for them to scrape off. So it is true. So they are pretty good size. You can imagine if you have, you know, 5-6 of those on your back, if you're a little bee, that's pretty hard on you, taking a lot of your energy.
And I also wondered, how do they get into the hive anyway? They've got to crawl in.
They do. And generally, it's a bee getting a varroa mite on it somewhere, from another bee, usually. I mean, that's how they once they get into a colony, they can easily move around, of course. And then they spread with the bees, even when they go off and start new colonies. But where do they come from originally? That's a good question. In this particular article on Entomology Today, it talked about how the varroa mite is native to the Asian honeybee. So that was its original host, you know, in the wild. But then at some point in time, it got moved into European honeybee. So probably it was by humans, I'm going to guess, because I don't know that Asian honeybees would ever be, you know, nesting or in close proximity necessarily to the European honeybee. So somehow it got moved into the European honeybee. And what's so interesting is that what this article's about is how the varroa mites can camouflage themselves, their own odor, by mimicking the odor of the honeybee, and how quickly they adapted from their native host, the Asian honeybee, to the European honeybee. And this group of scientists that were studying this found that this can happen in a matter of days, that they can, the mites.
So you'd think that would have to be generations.
You would think it would be generations. You know, we think about evolution and how long, you know, different traits get passed along and how slow that can be. But in this case, these varroa mites, because they already have this capacity in their chemistry, their body chemistry, to mimic these hydrocarbons, these chemicals that are on the surface of the honeybees, they already have that. And so very quickly they can detect what the European honeybees' hydrocarbon chemical odor, cue is. And not only that, it's even varies somewhat even from colony to colony. So there's slight differences. And so to avoid being detected, so you mentioned, you know, why don't they know they're there? Well, one thing is they do hide on their back. But also if they're using this chemical camouflage, basically like a perfume that mimics what the honeybee's perfume is, they don't detect that they're there because they're camouflaged in their odor.
And so these mites are sucking the juices and weakening the bees.
Exactly.
And so if the population in the hive is weak from that, you can imagine why maybe colony collapse disorder comes into play, because maybe that's a pesticide event or something else that's happening to
the
hive.
So these varroa mites, and there's another kind of mite that honeybees get called tracheal mites, which are their breathing tubes. Those are the mites that live in those. Pesticides, habitat loss, these are all factors that we now are quite certain have kind of come together. There's a couple viruses as well. So any one of them alone have been there all along and have, you know, put some stress on honeybees, but we just kind of got to this breaking point where the straw that broke the camel's back kind of breaking point, where there's just too many of these stresses. And that's what we're seeing has happened with our honeybee colony collapse problems.
Any research that might show adaptability by the bees? Because usually that's how nature works.
There is. So this is like an arms race. And so you could think about as the bad guy, in this case, the varroa mite, you know, can quickly adapt and mimic the chemical odor of the bees. And then, maybe the honeybee can change. But one of the adaptations that some bee apiculturalist researchers are working on at the University of Minnesota that's become quite well known and it seems to be pretty successful, is bees that are more hygienic. So kind of these super hygienic bees, bees that do more grooming, that are very careful, and the workers are very meticulous and keeping their hive clean, so to speak.
And these are not European honeybees?
Oh, they are, but okay. they're just like certain strains or populations that some researchers observed were more hygienic, super hygienic, they're calling them. And so now they've been breeding those. And if you get queens from those kinds of bees, that they tend to pass on those genetic traits then to their offspring. So there are some adaptations, some, part of this arms race to kind of combat the varroa mite and other things that they are starting to find are available and starting to try to breed those into the commercial honeybee lines.
Are you seeing, as far as bees are concerned, how is colony collapse disorder coming along? I keep hearing of crashes, but then I hear some success stories.
So the overall national statistics that I read about a while back when they published a report was in the mean or the kind of the, again, national kind of course, you can be outside this range. It was 30-40% losses over this past winter is what the kind of number that I've heard bandied about. So that's still fairly high. I mean, it's much higher than we would like it to be. I think, we'd love it to be close to zero as possible. But I think around the 10-20 was kind of more normal, realizing that some winters are harsher, than others. But that 30-40 is still on the high end, but it's not as bad as it was when colony collapse first really started coming on strong about 10 to 12 years ago, when we were getting losses of 50, 60, 70%, not uncommonly. So it's better. So there are some successes, as you mentioned, but we still have a ways to go.
Okay. What else do you have?
So we had another story that you picked up on that I thought was also very interesting. And one of these is it includes a little bit more about insect chemistry and how they can use it in a way that humans never realized that insects could use chemical odors. In this case, it's about a predatory wasp. It's native to China, and this particular wasp was picked as among the top 10 insect species for 2015. So what they do is they just select insects that they think have some very unique characteristics or something that makes them a popular insect to learn more about. And this particular wasp in China, she uses hollow stems of plants to make her nest to lay her eggs in. And she actually uses spiders to feed her young. So she paralyzes them and puts them in these little nests and then use a little mud, little soil caps in between. But then at the top of this nest, so we've heard about those kind of things before, she then goes and gathers this common but actually fairly toxic ant. And it's an ant that has a pretty powerful sting. And so it's a common odor that predators, insects in that area would be aware of. And she puts about a dozen of those at the very top of her stem, kind of like the cap, to all her nests, her eggs with their spider food for when they hatch and have something to eat later on. But she uses this chemical odor to deter other insects, other predators from wanting to come and then, attack her nest and eat her eggs or the spiders that she's provisioned for her young.
How would...
And so we never know.
That.
This is the first example of an insect using a chemical to ward off, other predators. So that's why this particular wasp was selected. And I like the name of it too. It was an interesting name. What did they call it? The Boneyard? I've forgotten the name. It was Bone Something. It was a kind of an interesting name, I guess, named after where they put the bones in little containers and some of the, human bones.
Yeah.
There's those ossuaries.
What
are they called? Anyways, it was named after that. So I thought that was kind of an interesting name. I can't find the name on here now, but it was Bone Something. Boneyard or bone something, bone stick. So anyway, that was one of the insects that was picked as a top 10 insect for 2015.
And I think a walking stick.
And a walking stick was the other one, also native to Asia. It was in Vietnam, I believe, just because of its large size, like 9 inches long. And so amazing that this is the first time this walking stick had ever been collected. And
wow.
So you think about a nine-inch insect that has never been, I don't want to say that some of the local people hadn't noticed it. They certainly had, but no entomologists. And they had they had done insect collecting in this region of Vietnam before, but no one had seen it until this past year. And so a 9-inch long insect can escape our detection. It just is kind of demonstrates their ability to camouflage. They do come out at night to feed. They're plant feeders. So they're hiding during the day, mimicking, you know, sticks. That's what their camouflage is. But also just amazing diversity that there still is out there that we don't even yet know about.
My daughter's in Cambodia, which is right next door. So I'll tell her if she sees a nine-inch
walking
little
stick
that's moving, that she's seeing something that's just been documented. So, well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more. If you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be right back.
Yes, we have no bananas, but CDs I've got. Hi there, this is Bill McLaughlin of Exploring Music, and I get CDs from musician friends, from managers, from publishers, from record labels. I get so many, I put them into a big cardboard box. And the best of these CDs, the ones I want to listen to again and again, go into a smaller box labeled Bill's Keepers. Join us for Bill's Keepers this week on Exploring Music.
Weekday afternoons at 1 and Monday through Thursday night at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
What was the happiest moment in your life and why?
How do you want to be remembered?
Has your life been different than what you might have imagined?
What are your dreams for me?
What questions have you always wanted to ask? I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. Record a conversation with someone you love when our mobile recording booth comes to town.
Join us in July at the Uinta County Library in Vernal. Utah Public Radio will begin taking reservations on June 18th. Details at upr.org.
Thank you for staying with us on the program. This is The Zesty Garden, and Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. We have about 8 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. Or go online and send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So the next article that we're going to talk about has to do with ants. And it seems like chemicals... you would never think with insects necessarily, but the more you delve into them, the more you realize how much insects use chemicals to, you know, either ward off things or to hide themselves or, you know, whatever. So in this case, I'm not sure why they need to smell like blue cheese, but...
Yeah, so this is the common name of this is the odorous house ant. We don't have it here in the western United States, but it is common in the east. And... I heard this story. They did a nice interview with this researcher on NPR, and I heard it on the air, and I was very intriguing that this one entomologist had always just thought that they smelled like blue cheese when he smelled the odor given off by the ants. But then he'd heard his other colleagues and just other people say that, oh no, it's rotten coconut. And so then that kind of piqued his interest. Why does it smell like rotten coconuts to some people and blue cheese to others? And so he delved into this, got a chemical ecologist involved with him to check out what the odors actually were, what the chemical components of the odors were. And they found there's a lot of that rotten coconut actually has a lot of the same chemicals, compounds in it as blue cheese. So it's a similar kind of odor. And that this ant has, evolved to emit this odor. And so...
Do we know why?
They were just speculating. They don't know why for certain, but they were just speculating that it might have to do with, protection, like kind of, you know, masking them, their colony, that if a predator were to come along and say, ooh, that smells, you know, like rotten, something bad, they wouldn't bother the ants, dig up the ants and eat the larvae, which is one of the main concerns that ant colonies have, is certain kinds of animals that will eat their larvae and pupae. And so that way it helps protect the colony. That was their speculation. Mm. They didn't prove that, but just that they found out that actually rotten coconuts, blue cheese, and these odorous house ants all have these common these common chemicals was pretty cool.
I'm imagining these ants sitting down to dinner and having salads with their blue cheese on it. We have a caller. We have Bettina from Springdale. Hi, Bettina. How can we help?
Hi, I really enjoy your program. I was recently back at the Audubon Society in Connecticut, And they were talking about and lecturing about that it's no longer a big mystery, that the recent scientific research confirms the role of pesticides in pollinator decline. And they talked about the findings of the European Safety Authority report that these chemicals are of critical concern to bee health, as well as to birds because of the Audubon Society. And even in California, they talked about 89% of all water samples taken in the rivers and creeks and drains in the state contained serious chemical residues and samples, and they were levels above the EPA guidelines. And so they talked about what we can do as pollinator declines continue at an unprecedented rate. The time for action is now, and they said to that these things are going into the global food system, and the natural world warrants permits and prohibition with these. Of course, you know, Bayer and Monsanto, they continue to, you know, not really look at it. But there are some places that you can go on the web. There's one called beeprotective.org to find out how you can help the effort and how you can get to your community schools and local government to take action to protect pollinators. And I, as a child, remember tons of butterflies everywhere. And, of course, to see one, a monarch or whatever, you know, swallowtail butterfly is rare nowadays. And so I think we're in big trouble. And I don't know. I know you mentioned a lot of times about spraying and everything, but I have friends that have hives up in Utah Valley. And they lost 50% of their hives that were down in the valley last year from just local whatever people were dumping in the environment, spraying. But their hives up in the mountains weren't affected, where they do less spraying and everything. So,
well, those are all really good comments, and it is true. And EPA is taking action. There always is a, you know, a period of time for people to respond and so forth, but certainly a lot of actions are being taken. There's a new effort, President Obama, you know, mandated that we do more pollinator protection, and so there are new restrictions on which types of insecticides or products that can be sprayed. But I do want to point out that when we talk about spraying, there's many different kinds of materials that can be sprayed, and so, you know, it is true that if you don't protect your apple trees, for example, from collie moth, you will have wormy apples in most cases. And so we, in our integrated pest management recommendations, we try to provide products that are not, you know, low toxicity, that aren't going to cause the kinds of problems you mentioned. So I know Brian's signaling that we were kind of, we're just about out of time. So,
okay.
But we really appreciate your comments.
Bettina,
thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And I've talked about this a lot before, but I like using the spinosad because I know it's very targeted and I can eat my apples the same day. It's the caterpillars that eat it that it kills. So,
right.
And it leaves the beneficials alone. So that's a good thing.
Right. So that's the kinds of products we try to encourage people to use and not the broad spectrum things.
Well, Diane, thank you for coming in.
Yeah, it's been
fun.
Thank you.
We've reached our time already again.
Go so fast.
You've been listening to Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist and comes onto the program the third Thursday of every month. In our gardening calendar, there are a couple of items coming up. So the Wasatch Community Gardens is hosting an urban garden and farm tour highlighting gardens in Salt Lake from June 20th from 10 to 2. The tour offers demonstrations on urban chicken keeping, small space intensive gardening, school gardens, water-wise growing, container gardening, permaculture gardens, small livestock, rainwater catchment, beekeeping, small urban farming, season extenders, and more. Details are at Wasatch stokesgardens.org. And the Stokes Nature Center in Logan Canyon is featuring a wildlife naturalist hike on Saturday, June 27th from 10 to 1. Participants will meet at First Dam. Information and registration is at logannature.org. And the Ashley Valley Farmers Market is located in downtown Vernal at the City Park, 225 East Main Street, and runs Saturdays from 9 to 1. July through September. I also wanted to mention the Wayne County Farmers Market in Torrey. It's Saturday at each Saturday at 4 o'clock on Center and Main. And then my last item here is the Central Utah Penstemon Festival. It's June 26th and 27th. On Friday the 26th, you can stop in at Holden, Utah at Great Basin Natives to discuss plants for sustainable and drought-tolerant landscaping. And then on Saturday, June 27th at 9 a.m. in Elsinore, you get to hear Bill Varga, horticultural consultant for Utah State University and the Utah Botanical Center, and his presentation will be on perennials native to the Intermountain region. Anyway, there are topics throughout that particular day. For more information, you can go to their Facebook page at Central Utah Penstemon Festival and register by the 22nd. It's $30. After that, or at the door, it's $39. And you can also register online. There's information at the Utah Native Plant Society website, unps.org. Stay tuned. There's more to come. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and it's our segment, Going Native. Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery, just south of Richfield in Joseph, is my guest. And we're talking today about thin leaf alder or mountain alder. Or alder, and I just have to say this word because I love tenuifolia.
Right.
Tell me about this particular alder.
Well, you know, a lot of times we have a hard time finding a tree that will grow on the lawn successfully because of all of the water, regular watering. And doing my research, looking through all of my books, whatever, and I came across this, and I happened to see a really nice stand of this alder up above Fish Lake, where I live. Saw it growing there, and I thought, that is a fabulous-looking tree. And it was growing next to a stream, and so, you know, okay, it will take the water, it can tolerate the water. The leaves are bright, bright green, and very, very hardy, very symmetrical, you might say a symmetrical, nice branching habit. And I did not ever see any information, diseases or insects that affected it. And so I collected seed, and I've got it growing in my nursery to sell, and I have planted it in my display area of my nursery because all the water, we're always watering the trees in the pots. However, it hated it. It just sat there, and it turned yellow and chlorotic.
Salt.
Yes. And that's not going to work. You can't have this tree in the middle of your display area. So I planted another one out on my hillside out in my garden, in my landscape. And it's doing beautifully. It's big and green and lush and really nice. It's in well-drained soil, kind of on a little slope. And it gets watered maybe once every 2 weeks. And it's doing very well.
And how tall does it get?
Around 35 feet in this area.
Okay.
In the books, it'll say 70 feet.
Oh, that's...
But that's the Midwest where it is really humid and has a lot of moisture. And I know Mike Koontz, he's the one that turned me on to this, that here where it's dry, the air is dry, they're not going to get anywhere near as big. We don't have as long as growing season.
So is this more dense growing, or would you use it as a specimen?
Either. It could be a screen. You could, you know, any tree you could make a screen. But it's prettier, I think, as a specimen tree.
And it's very cold hardy all the way down to zone 2.
It's very cold hardy, yes.
But yet you can grow up through zone 6.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to talk about those zones. How does the USDA decide their zones? I mean, they now have Cache County as a zone 5 into zone 6, and I'm like, there's no way that I'm going to grow the zone 6 plant here. I might as well not even try it.
Like, it has to do with how many days of a certain temperature for how many years. It's not just 1 year, it's a group of years.
Yeah. Well, I know they haven't put their sensors in my garden, so I'm at cold zone 4 in Hyde Park. So this is a good one because it goes from zones 2 to 6.
Yes, it's cold hardy.
Belongs to the birch family?
Yes. Really cool. The seeds on it are really cool. It's a cluster of tiny, tiny pine cones. And I use them in my wreath workshop that I do in the wintertime, and they're just popular. They're just the coolest part of the tree, I think, is looking at this beautiful, beautiful shade tree and seeing these pine cones.
And attracts songbirds?
Oh, yes. The birds eat those seeds in this.
Tolerates poor soil.
Right. That's alkaline soil. And that is the one thing that was agreed upon through all the books that I read up on this, was it tolerates the poor soil. And it's a good plant for reestablishing bogs or whatever.
This is one that does require a little bit more water. You wouldn't want to put it in an area where it doesn't get any water at all other than what nature provides. So on the edge of a grassy area.
Right.
Would be good for it. I find this interesting. This next fact you've got is that it fixes nitrogen.
Yes. Isn't that cool?
Why don't you explain what that means? I know what it does for my beans. Is that the same thing here?
It is exactly the same thing. It takes the nitrogen out of the air and moves it down into the soil. Basically, it's what it does.
So maybe would you pair it with some plants that might like a little bit of extra nitrogen?
I think that could work.
Okay. You also have it with shady perennials, geraniums, columbines, and Wasatch penstemons.
Right. As an understory. I'd much rather put flowers under a tree than mulch or rocks. You know.
Well, the flowers themselves become the mulch.
That's what I was going to say. The flowers are the mulch.
And it looks so much better. Well, this is the thin leaf alder or mountain alder. And that's our recommendation from Jeanette Warner. She is the owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph. Thank you for joining me, Jeanette.
Thank you very much.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and for the next little while, I would like to read from a book called The Triumph of Seeds by Thor Hansen, and I'll begin today with his introduction called The Fierce Energy. It begins with an epigraph by George Bernard Shaw from The Vegetarian Diet, according to Shaw. Think of the fierce energy concentrated in an acorn. You bury it in the ground, and it explodes into a giant oak. Bury a sheep, and nothing happens but decay. I put the hammer down and peered at the seed. Not a scratch. Its dark surface looked just as smooth and perfect as it had when I'd found it on the floor of the rainforest. There, lying in the mud and mulch, surrounded by sounds of water dripping and the constant chirr of insects, the seed had looked ready to burst open with the promise of bud swell, roots, and leafy green. Now, under the hum of fluorescent lights in my office, the damn thing seems indestructible. I picked up the seed and settled it neatly in my palm, a little larger than a walnut, but flatter and dark, its heavy shell as hard as tempered steel. A thick seam ran lengthwise around the edge, but no amount of prodding and prying with a screwdriver had opened it so much as a crack. Vigorous squeezing with a long-handled pipe wrench hadn't proved any better. And now a hammer. Blows appeared to be useless. Obviously, I needed something heavier. My university office took up a corner of the old forestry department herbarium, a largely forgotten place where dried plant collections lined the walls in dusty metal cabinets. I'll interrupt here to say that I worked for several years at the herbarium here on campus, and some of us called it a plant morgue because we dealt not in living plants but pressed dry plants. Once a week, a group of retired faculty members gathered there for coffee and bagels, reminiscing about research trips, favorite trees, and developmental infighting from decades past. My desk, too dated from an earlier era, a time when people built office furniture from welded steel, chrome, and double weight formica. It was large enough for a fleet of mimeograph machines and teletypes and hefty enough to withstand the shock waves of a nuclear attack. Placing the seed close beside one of its hulking feet, I heaved the desk upward and let it fly. It dropped with a resounding crash, launching the seed sideways to ricochet off the wall and skitter out of sight under a cabinet. When I retrieved it, the seed's dark sides looked completely unscathed. So I tried again, crash, and again, crash, my frustration mounting with every failed attempt. Finally, I crouched down, pinned the seed between desk and leg and wall, and started flailing at it wildly with a hammer. My anger in that moment, however, didn't come close to that of the red-faced forestry professor who suddenly stormed into my room shouting, "What the hell is going on in here? I'm trying to teach a class next door." Clearly, I needed a quieter seed-breaking method, particularly since it wasn't just one seed that I needed to open. Two crates in the closet held hundreds of them, not to mention more than 2,000 leaves and bits of bark, each one painstakingly gathered over months of field work in the forests of Costa Rica and Nicaragua. Transforming those samples into data would make up the bulk of my doctoral dissertation, or not, as things were going. Eventually, I discovered that a stout blow with a mallet and rock chisel would do the job nicely. But my struggle to open the first seed taught me an important evolutionary lesson. Why, I asked myself, would a seed shell be so impossibly hard to split? Wasn't the whole part of a seed to throw itself wide and let the young plant spring forth? Surely the thick husk hadn't evolved merely to thwart a hapless graduate student. The answer, of course, was fundamental as a broody hen guarding her clutch of eggs or a lioness defending her cubs. To the tree I was studying, the next generation meant everything, an evolutionary imperative worth any investment of energy and adaptive creativity. And in the history of plants, no single event has ensured the protection, dispersal, and establishment of their progeny more than the invention of seeds. In business, people mark the ultimate success of a product by its brand recognition and universal availability. When I lived in a mud-walled hut in Uganda, 4 hours from a paved road on the edge of a jungle called the Impenetrable Forest, I could still buy a bottle of Coca-Cola within a 5-minute walk from my front door. Marketing executives fantasize about that kind of ubiquity, and in the natural world, seeds have it. From tropical rainforest to alpine meadows and Arctic tundra, seed plants dominate landscapes and define entire ecosystems. A forest, after all, is named for its trees and not for the monkeys and birds that leap and flutter within it. And everyone knows to call the famed Serengeti grassland, not zebra land with grass. When we pause to examine the underpinnings of natural systems, time and again we find seeds and plants that bear them, playing the most vital roles. While an ice cold soda tastes pretty good on a tropical afternoon, the Coca-Cola analogy only goes so far in explaining the evolution of seeds. But it is true in more than one respect. Natural selection, like commerce, rewards a good product. The best adaptations spread through time and space, in turn spurring further innovation in a process Richard Dawkins called the greatest show on earth. Some traits have become so widespread they seem axiomatic. Animal herds, for example, have 2 eyes, 2 ears, some kind of a nose and a mouth. Fish gills extract dissolved oxygen from water. Bacteria reproduce by splitting, and the wings of insects come in pairs. Even for biologists, it's easy to forget these fundamentals were once brand new, clever novelties spun from the sheer persistence of evolution's trial and error. In the plant world, the idea of seeds ranks right along with photosynthesis as one of our chief assumptions. Even children's literature takes the notion for granted. In Ruth Krauss's classic book, The Carrot Seed, a silent little boy disregards all the naysayers, patiently watering and weeding around his planting until at last a great carrot springs up, just as the little boy had known it would. Though famous for how its simple drawings transformed the genre of picture books, Krauss's story also tells us something that the tiniest pip contains, what George Bernard Shaw called the fierce energy, the spark, and all the instructions needed to build a carrot. An oak tree, wheat, mustard, sequoias, or any one of the estimated 352,000 kinds of plants that use seeds to reproduce. We live in a world of seeds, from our morning coffee and bagel to cotton in our clothes, the cup of cocoa we might drink before bed. Seeds surround us all day long. They give us food and fuel, intoxicants and poisons, oils, dyes, fibers, and spices. Without seeds, there would be no bread, no rice, no beans, corn, or nuts. They are quite literally the staff of life, the basis of diets, economies, and lifestyles around the globe. They anchor life in the wild, too. Seed plants now make up more than 90% of our flora. They are so commonplace, it's hard to imagine that for over 100 million years, other types of plant life dominated the earth. Roll back the clock, and we find seeds evolving as trivial players in a flora ruled by spores, where tree-like club mosses, horsetail, and ferns formed the forests that remain with us in the form of coal. From this humble beginning, the seed plant steadily gained advantage, first with conifers, cycads, ginkgos, and then a great diversification of flowering species, until now it is the spore bearers and algae that watch from the sidelines. This dramatic triumph of seeds poses an obvious question. Why are they so successful? What traits and habits have allowed seeds and plants that bear them to so thoroughly transform the planet? The answers frame the narrative of this book and reveal not only why seeds thrive in nature, but why they are so vital to people. So I'll continue with this book next time. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.